20
possible.
Minutes.
20 minutes seems to be a sufficient amount of time for anyone to sit in even soft chairs. And today doesn't seem to be even half over with yet. I would like to give you some idea of some of the trials and tribulations that we have had in San Diego. And contrary to popular belief, San Diego is not in the forefront of anything. You may talk with administrators and may give you the opposite impression. However, some of us that have attempted to do some things in that district have found out otherwise. The microcomputer aspect of the high school program started in early 1975 when a few of the brighter kids that read popular mechanics and popular electronics found an issue in the library with a microcomputer on the front. And of course we all know things that led up to that. Approximately five or six students met with a teacher, and they decided to try and fund and obtain a small system which they would build and then operate. Initially, there's a great deal of administrative reluctance to get involved in anything like this because reputations can be lost. They can also be gained, but they're primarily concerned with losing reputations. This particular principal was pushed, shoved, cajoled, and whatever along the lines. First of all, he came from the social science area, right? So he's not familiar with computer technology at all. He's kind of anti-math department, and you know the math department is the only department that saves a school, right? Because it's the epitome of human knowledge. A little biased comment there. And then computers are thought to belong to those people that walk around and look weird in white coats and scribble things on walls that are mathematical, right? And they're not supposed to be human. And those of you that have tried to implement computer systems in schools know what I'm talking about. And those of you that haven't tried, you will find out what that is. Obtaining money at this particular time in any school district is a problem. So the first thing you have to do is locate the budget printout. And in the state of California, budget documents are public domain. You may go in as a citizen and ask to see the budget printout. However, most administrators have difficulty reading it because it's a computerized printout. And so immediately, they are a little reluctant to give you a budget printout. What do you want it for? And so we took a look at the budget printout, and we found a variety of monies in a variety of accounts that only required the principal's signature to transfer them and accumulate them into one account. So we got that accomplished without too much difficulty. We also took a look around at some of the other schools, and whether any of you are administrators or not, you should know that sometimes some principals charge things against other high schools that are not theirs, and vice versa. And then they play the game, see if you can catch me. And usually a year or so later, someone will find out that someone has charged from one high school against the account of another high school, but it's too late because the budget year is over with, and it came out of the general fund. Anyway, you should know that these games are played. And so every year they change school budget numbers so that if a principal transfers, it eliminates some of the temptation. Right. Well, these are things that are not normally bantered about, but if you're going to go in and attempt to work within the structure, you should know about. Also, a source of funds can be the PTA. However, you're going to need some inside connections there. You're going to need some parents that are, one, involved in computers and can push it. unfortunately, most areas still believe computers are of the HAL variety, right? And they want to know if it's going to talk to you, what will it say, and if it will reach out and grab you. And now that the demon seed is out, right, you really got problems to work with. We finally got the monies accumulated. We traded with other schools on personnel units, TA time, teacher assistant time, and in some districts those are traded 5 hours of teacher assistant time for 1 hour of teaching time, and then that translates into money via personnel units, so that you can arrange to swing all kinds of deals to accumulate money. And I'm telling you these things after we really worked a long time, so I hope they're of good use to you, and you do not banter them about helter-skelter, because then they will close off those channels, right? Then we'll have to figure out another way to go about it. Well, we amassed in approximately 2 weeks pretty close to $5,500, which in a tight money situation is a rather healthy sum. We had originally thought that we would move into a very, very small system, somewhere around 8K core, and hook it up to a teletype that we'd been using for a timeshare system, and move on from there. Well, with the $5,400, we really put together a system. We put 20K of core in it. We brought three interfaces. We bought two additional teletypes, a typograph, and vectored interrupt, so we were going timeshare with it. And at this particular time, several students have developed the software for a 5-terminal or 5-port timeshare system with that original Altair. Well, we ran into the typical problems of obtaining the materials. The floppy disk came 18 months after the original Altair arrived. We didn't get all the field changes for the Altair, so the memory boards in the 4K were wired improperly, and it took us a while to figure that one out. They also sent us defective memory chips. You know, this is ancient history to most of you. The first memory chips they put out with their old 4K boards didn't function too well, and they didn't tell us, and so we were sitting around and we were losing all kinds of information. Because of those, we finally did receive some notification from the company, and they repaired those boards with additional chips. Oh, we had the usual problems putting it together. However, if you only look at the problems, I think you have overlooked some of the outstanding educational experiences that can occur during a construction experience with computers. One, you've got to develop a problem-solving approach that is other than textbook. You've got a computer that has to operate. Now, the assumption in school is that there is one answer to every problem for every question that's listed at the back of every chapter. And so the strategy in school then is to find the one answer. Once you found it, you can smile, walk off, and move on to another one. But when you plug your computer in, you cannot make the assumption there is only one thing wrong. You cannot make the assumption that anything is working properly. And it doesn't, right? Those of you that have put it together know it doesn't work properly. So now you have a real problem-solving situation in which prestige is on the line. You've got to get that machine up because everyone else is laughing at you, telling you it couldn't be done. The administrators reluctantly went along with it, knowing that it was going to fail. And the data processing department is offering all kinds of incentives for the thing to fail. They're a little jealous, and they're very territorial about the electronic data processing area. And if any of you are unaware of that, attempt to suggest or take some of your Swift kids down and let them tour the data processing center. I think I can be fairly safe in assuming that you will only be allowed to take those kids through once. The experience that we had, we only lasted half of our tour. And they didn't touch any equipment. All they did was ask a few questions. And that was it. And we were told with written memo, no longer would tours be welcome through the central computer system. Well, that's fine. We've got our own system now, and we're developing our own center. And the more problems that are thrown in front of your kids, the more solutions will be generated. And what's interesting about the solutions is they work, and you've got the kids involved in some positive things, when most of the things now concerning school is very negative. High truancy rate, high dropout rate, they're not learning to read, they can't compute. Everything seems to be negative. In a situation like this, you've got kids doing things positive, but you're also stepping on territorial toes. Well, we'll get to some more of that. In addition to some of the construction problems and troubleshooting, you also have to make some assumptions about test equipment. And we're always used to running and grabbing something and then looking at it. When you look through the microscope, you assume that the microscope is working properly. If you use a voltmeter to take a voltage reading, you assume the voltmeter is working properly. If you use an oscilloscope to take some waveforms, you assume the oscilloscope is working properly. So again, you've got some information that they have got to work around, assess, and make some judgments about when they start working with the machinery. All right, we finally got it together. It took us a month to, it took us 3 weeks to get it together. It took us 6 weeks to get the bugs out. And we had solder bridges because someone would have to go to class and he would just sort of pass the soldering iron over to the next kid that slid into the chair, not telling him where he had left off. And then someone yells something and they look away and there's a solder bridge. Well, you know, they didn't really do it intentionally, but it was there. We had some interesting things. I imagine most of you that have put together systems have, hopefully not, but have possibly soldered transistors in backwards. You know, just twisted them around. We had about five done that way, and we didn't lose any of them. Right? So somebody was watching over us. We also had some ICs that were put in backwards because the kids didn't pay attention to the little dots. You know, as long as they fit, that's where they go. And a variety of other things. We did not lose any parts by overheating. And that was a main worry that I had with these kids. Let me give you some background on these kids. Just looking over the audience, it's rather intriguing audience that you are. Nice. This system was put together in a predominantly minority-oriented school where the kids had run off teachers, you know? These were the kids that Bill Cosby talks about in his records. And is probably one of the reasons why we were allowed to go ahead and stick our neck out and buy the equipment. But you know what? Those kids put the system together. And those kids made the system work. And they may not speak standard English, but by gosh, they can work through a problem. So this can be done with what's called culturally disadvantaged kids. Well, they may be a little bit further along than some of the rest of us would like to admit. Also, they're great scroungers, right? If you need some parts, or you need some information, they know where to get it. Don't ask them where, but they know where to get it. Even money, but we had to take and limit that. And so we made it very clear that we had to go through the normal funding channels for school. We couldn't go out and hustle, right? No hustling. All right. Immediately, as soon as it was operating, some of the administrators started to sit up and take notice, because if there's one thing that bothers one administrator, it's success of another one. And so now you have the starting of a fad, right? And the only problem you've got is controlling it, and you can't control it. So you've got to let it run and just watch. Of course, at this particular school, we had some problems with kids. We had a walkout, you know, action, and really action. The police were on campus, you know, a year before we started this. Police were on campus. You know, it was just like watching TV. And tempers were up. And so one of the responses of the central office was to check on truancy. Too many kids out of class causing too much trouble. So they called in the data processing department for a computerized attendance procedure. Those of you that have been around computers know that that's been in some districts for quite a while, and it's not a very monumental problem at all. It's rather trivial. The data processing department told us that we couldn't do it. So we turned three kids loose, and they had it done in a month. And then as soon as the data systems department found out about it, they came down and took it over. Right? That doesn't build very good public relations, especially if you want to move along. And we found that out a little bit later. Right after we had ordered our equipment, there was a directive that came down from the data processing department that all equipment purchased relative and with any relation whatsoever to computer had to go through their department. And we took them at their word. And since these were kits, in California, there's two basic forms of funding: capital outlay and instructional supply. And if you buy equipment assembled for use, it's capital outlay. And if you buy kits, it's instructional supply. And in the public schools anyway, instructional supply is on the principal's signature. So we're very, very dutiful in our adherence to their memo, and since it wasn't equipment, we did not obtain their okay. They heard about that, and it wasn't too much longer until we had another memo. As soon as we had it up and running, there was another memo sent that no computer systems built by students would be placed on the district maintenance contract. Right? They're trying everything. Which was great, but they lost that one too. Because what we did was go ahead and design our own computer technology course and train a small cadre of students. You know, there's always some computer nuts on campus, and those kids will follow you. They smell computers. And if you've got a computer on campus, if you've got one IC chip, they'll find you. You know, they'll get there. And so you take these kids and you build into the situation a one-hour block of time during the day. This is what we did. Built a one-hour block of time, and they worked together, and they formed what's called an operator maintenance group. And after they completed a little orientation course, we licensed them status. They got status now. And only those kids that are licensed may pull boards, replace components, check out the system. Anybody else can work one of the terminals, but if anything goes wrong, it's got to be a licensed operator that is brought in. And some of the topics that those operator technicians cover: the development of computers in a historical sense, including the impact upon humankind, with conjectures for the future. foundations of computer mathematics, including basic Boolean algebra and logic. And then they move into electronic circuits. And there we cover AND, OR, NAND, NOR, flip-flops, and a few more. And then we move into the components of the computer system at the block level. So they've got an overall picture of the computer from the block level. That comes primarily, I think, from my original indoctrination by the Army. You know, you had to do everything at the block level, and then you went to the component level. And it's carried over. They did a good job on me. And then we go to the component level of computer systems and look at the boards and look at the different functions of the different components. Then we also cover test equipment and then troubleshooting techniques, both at the block level and at the component level. After all this was finished, I think we came up with some rather interesting insights. At least we thought they were interesting. One, young children can understand the internal workings of computer systems. And they can understand them much better than some of us older folks because they belong to the computer generation and we do not. And there is a computer gap. And if you don't believe it, watch some 6 and 7 and 8 year old kids that play with computers. Nothing to it. It's a friend to them. And most of us have a little reluctance to sit down and do some things with it yet. Students are very creative in their use of the computer. You have no idea what they're going to do. And it is extremely intriguing to watch them do some of these things. Students at all levels, even some of those kids that are considered to be dumb. They may be misidentified gifted kids, but some of those kids can develop very sophisticated software in a very short period of time. Adults, that is teachers and data processing personnel, can become very threatened when students start using computer equipment in creative ways. And you will be surprised how often this comes up. The computer may solve some problems, but its use generates many other problems that need to be solved. And any teacher, administrator, or data processing person that can be replaced by a computer deserves to be replaced by a computer. Students gain insights and understandings in areas by becoming involved in computer applications in these areas. If you've ever tried to figure out a simulation in an area, you will understand how much you have to know about the area in which you are constructing that simulation. What happens many times when
the second issue, it seems to me, is to provide the computing power, after providing computer power, to make the computing power responsive power. The thinking device, the extension of thinking machine, subscribed to and supported by its users, is the most responsive to their needs because it has been developed by their thinking. To grow a people-oriented computer system must respond to the developing needs of its constituent users. I think, at its best, the Lawrence Hall approach is cast in that mold. So we provide computer access to a wide variety of users, from home users and primary school users to universities and colleges and the Berkeley campus. All of these groups are exploring now and answering for themselves that most important question that I began postulating: what is it for, really? Why are computers good at all? How should they be used? And part of what I do is to collect answers to those questions. I get part of the time to drive out to places and meet kids and have them ask any question they can think of asking and have me attempt to answer them and look at their teletype and react to questions on a personal level. So let me outline a few types of responses or answers to the question that we hear. At a school like the Montessori School or primary school in San Francisco, the answer is the computer is a means towards self-reliance and exploration of the world outside. In a setting like that, the computer becomes part of an integrated methodology. Teachers and fourth and fifth graders have written programs in the pilot language there, which do things such as draw a picture of a maple leaf and direct you to go out and find a leaf like that, come back to the terminal and start exploring why it is what it is and how it came to be. The other aspect is that of self-reliance. The last time I was out at the Montessori school, I was treated to the sight of a fourth grader rushing to the pay telephone to phone our computer operator up to complain that he was getting garbage on his teletype. The maintenance of the terminal and the responsibility for using the machine is delegated to the primary school students who run it. And our library has been enriched by programs written by these students that are now in our general program library. Another answer to the question, typified by a place like the California School for the Deaf, where we have a major program involving 12 interactive terminals, and which has been going on for about 3 years, cooperatively between the school and us, developing curriculum and writing materials. I think the answer is that the computer becomes a means toward personalizing education. In the case of deaf learners, with the types of difficulties they have, the extremely responsive and personalized and supportive capabilities of interactive computing become critically important. And there's nothing quite like viewing a room full of 12 terminals and 12 deaf kids who relate to a teletype differently than other students I've seen, much more physically, as they wrap their legs around the terminals very often and feel the vibration in the machine. One answer, then, is the personalization of experience in computing. Still another and very typical and very important means answer, I think, is that the computer provides a means toward social experience, toward social sharing and appreciation between people. In a school in Walnut Acres, which you saw one photograph from, there's a math lab which was parent-developed. One of the big mundane questions that keeps getting asked is, how do we pay for it? From a statistical point of view, people confront that question more frequently than the more philosophical ones I'm indulging myself in right now. At Walnut Acres, one of the parents in the PTA on a trip to New York noticed that her son came back excited and involved with mathematics, because there was a special class he was taking through NYU where they had a simulated computer calculator course. And when she got back to California, she began to investigate possibilities for providing computer-related math experience. To see her kid be motivated in a subject that he had hated consistently for so many years meant a lot. So they explored us, and we did some seminars and workshops with them. And a computer lab grew out of very, what I again call roots experience kinds of effort. It came out of parents painting geo blocks and geo boards and hand cutting and hand making metric equivalent games, board games. And it came from personal support, personal fundraising for a terminal to reach our system at the Lawrence Hall. The exotic means by which this math lab was supported varied from an appearance by Leroy the magician, who volunteered his time for an evening on a payment basis, to the Fakery Bakery, which was a sale in which the production of baked goods was completely bypassed, And the people who would have baked the baked goods donated the money they would have spent in baking, and the people who would have bought them donated the money they would have spent in buying them to the math lab. So this is a home-built system, if you ask me. It's home-built from the ground up. It's a math lab. It's not protected by institutionalized protections or rules. It's not included in the school's budget. It is extremely responsive to and reliant on personal opinion. And it is, of course, the case that as children leave the school and parents in the PTA change, that they have no induction to or experience with the math lab and require valid explanations for why they should support such a thing. This characteristic of being open to inquiry, of having to depend for your survival, as the machine at the Lawrence Hall does, on money support, moral support, and personal commitment, rather than some kind of dependable subsidy. I think this is, as in public television or other instances, it makes life uncomfortable in some ways, but it provides a freedom for growing the way a plant does into its own shape, of finding its own form, that more institutionalized computing lacks. And I think it's one of the most important things we have, our dependence on the people who use and shape and make our system. One of the most dramatic examples I know of that the volunteer teacher of the math lab narrated to me was that of the children who, in a context like this, in a special context like this, found an opportunity to blossom. I'm again talking about the supportive or familial qualities of computers as a social institution or as an extended family-like structure. In particular, she introduced me to a fourth grader who had leukemia and who had lost all his hair and wore a cap to cover it, who before the development of this math lab activity had totally separated himself from all the other students because he was terribly afraid of any social contact, but who had found some kind of connectiveness with other students through the abilities that were opened up through the extensions of his own skills that he found using the machine, so that he had something to offer other people. And at that point, the fact that he was bald became much less important than that he had something to give. I think this is the finest and highest possibility that social at low enough cost that it's at least feasible for many families to try something like this per day or late at night. One of the slots is a 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. slot. It's primarily directed toward microcomputer hobbyists. We do have a cross-assembler that does any chip on the machine, and we figured people involved in doing cross-assemblies don't sleep at night. So resource development on the machine should provide a kind of social nexus, a kind of social connectedness or communication. And personal computing means using those lines of communication to advantage. The idea has developed steadily since McLuhan wrote Understanding Media that traditional social units like the extended family, the geographical group, are giving way to social units which are defined in terms of media connectedness, communications systems. There are all different kinds of networks that bind people together. Underarm deodorant advertisements on billboards or on television, white noise over the media, static, political campaigning. That ability to conquer distance and time and provide connectedness between people can be used indifferently, or it can be used very purposefully. And using an electric reality or a 20th century reality to provide a nexus which is personal in the sense of personal computing and purposeful in the way we've outlined, I think is the goal that we wish to strive for in the next decade.